from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, do's and don'ts under the new recreational marijuana law.
You will be allowed to have up to an ounce of marijuana in public. You can't smoke, but you can be carrying it.
Also today, a conversation with the head of the Massachusetts Republican Party.
I think you can be a supporter of Trump, of the president, and also be a supporter of a more moderate stream of Republicanism that we represent really here in Massachusetts.
And two Massachusetts films are out. We'll talk with Kenneth Lonergan about his elegiac Manchester by the Sea.
I don't want to talk about that.
You said he left you money so you could move.
Yeah, that doesn't mean...
Anyway, what's in Boston? You're a janitor.
Plus, reaction to last night's premiere of the Boston Marathon bombing movie, Patriots Day.
I didn't know if I was ready to see it, but after I left, I felt better.
It's Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As of 12:01 a.m. this morning, it's official. Recreational marijuana is legal in Massachusetts. Because today, the first part of the state's new marijuana law takes effect. But there are still plenty of things you cannot do. So joining us now to talk about what the law allows and prohibits is Norwood Police Chief William Brooks. Today also happens to be Chief Brooks' final day as president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association. Chief Brooks, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's run through some of the basics for folks. As of today in Massachusetts, regarding possession of marijuana, what's okay and how much?
Well, as everybody's heard by now, I guess, that possessing an ounce or less outside your home is lawful. Before today, it was decriminalized. You'd get a citation, and quite frankly, you didn't have to pay the citation. We had no recourse if you didn't, so it was almost, as a matter of fact, legal, but technically still a civil offense. So it became legal to possess an ounce or less. If you possess over an ounce but less than 2 ounces, it's a civil offense. And if you possess more than 2 ounces, it remains a crime. And then if you're in your primary residence, you can possess up to 10 ounces, but 9 of those ounces have to be locked up and 1 doesn't.
Ah, I see.
And you can also grow in your home.
Up to 6 plants per person in the home, but no more than 12 per household, and they're not supposed to be visible from a public space. That's for growing in your home. Now, what about smoking laws? Will it be legal to smoke marijuana in public spaces?
No, question 4 is specific that the public smoking of marijuana is not permitted under the statute. So, you know, you can have it, but you cannot smoke it. I think another provision of the law, too, that will surprise people, there are two that I think will surprise people. And again, this is something that was written by the folks who wrote question 4. Number one, you cannot have an unsealed bag of marijuana in the passenger compartment of your vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got that little bag of weed in your cup holder or in your console and an officer comes upon it or finds it or discovers it in some way, that's actually... the stiffest fine under question 4, which is $500.
I see.
And I'm not sure people are ready for that. The other thing that I think might surprise people is that question 4 is specific on the rights of property owners. So if you're a landlord or if you manage a rental property, you can prohibit your tenants from smoking marijuana on your property. You can also prohibit them from growing plants. So for people who would look forward to having the ability to smoke at home, before question 4, maybe they could have, but question 4 is pretty clear that property owners can prohibit the smoking marijuana, you know, in their apartments or on their property.
Right. Well, I've a couple questions about how now that recreational marijuana is phasing in terms of legality in Massachusetts, how that's changing what law enforcement does. I mean, how have police been preparing? Are there canine marijuana forces out there, or are there other changes that local law enforcement agencies have been making?
No, I mean, the only change is that we've told our officers what the changes are.
Mm-hmm.
The Executive Office of Public Safety and Security issued some guidance on it within the last couple of days. Secretary Bennett wrote, I think, what was an 8-page letter kind of outlining because the whole marijuana picture has become more complicated now. You've got legal marijuana, you've got some leftover decriminalized marijuana, you've got medical marijuana, and then you've still got criminal. So it's become, for anybody who thought, well, this will simplify the marijuana picture, it's the opposite. It's made it complicated. So we've given our officers some guidance as to, you know, what the law says. It's not that we're actually going to do anything differently. We just have to be aware of the new parameters.
Yeah. Sorry, Chief. I just wanted to ask you quickly about, because earlier you had mentioned about marijuana in cars. Is it going to be a challenge for officers to determine what to do about whether when they suspect that someone may be driving under the influence of marijuana?
It will be, but it's a challenge now. I mean, it's not like, I think what you're going to see now is you're going to see more cases of OUI drugs, people driving under the influence of marijuana. You've already started to see an uptick in that. And just what's been reported in the press, you know that the man who plowed into Trooper Clardy's cruiser was alleged to have THC in his system. Mm-hmm. The wrong way driver in Vermont who killed five. The two fatality crash in East Boston. So you're starting to see an uptick in it already. OUI drugs has always been a difficult charge to prove, but it's been going on for some time, and officers will continue to deal with it the way they have been. The difference, of course, between marijuana and alcohol is, number one, the breathalyzer, and number two, the per se limit.
Right.
So when you arrest someone for driving under the influence of alcohol, which the officer does when he has probable cause to believe that offense has occurred, number one, you have the breathalyzer that you can give the person. And number two, the limits mean something under the law. So if it's 0.05 or below, you're released and presumed not to be under the influence. 0.08 and above, you're presumed to be under the influence. And then the middle area is a gray area. Mm. And with marijuana, we don't have that. We don't have the equipment or the technology, and we don't really have limits that we can look at. That said, people drove under the influence of alcohol for years before we had a breathalyzer. And cops did. You know what you do? You make the stop, and when you see indicators of alcohol impairment, they do roadside tests. And based on the performance of those roadside tests, they would arrest or not arrest. And if they made an arrest, then they would testify as to their observation.
Yeah.
So we have that same kind of setup with marijuana or driving under the influence of opiates or driving under the influence of benzodiazepines or anything else that people do.
Yeah. So, Chief Brooks, final question for you in the last couple seconds that we have. What's your advice to people listening moving forward? The number one thing you'd like to them to think about now that marijuana is recreational marijuana is legal in Massachusetts?
Well, just because it's legal doesn't mean it's a good idea. I have genuine concerns about kind of the next generation. I've got not only kids, but now I've got grandkids. And, it's tough enough to be a parent these days without now having not only marijuana legal, but eventually sold in shops and advertised and that sort of thing. I don't think that this is a good idea at all. It's a burden on families and on parents who are bringing up kids. And then I hope the adults really just, if they're going to smoke marijuana, that they don't get behind the wheel.
Yeah.
This whole notion that people drive better when they're high on weed, or people who are high on weed drive slow, they never drive fast. That's all absurd, of course. None of it's true. I just hope people use good judgment.
Well, William Brooks is the chief of the Norwood Police Department. Today also happens to be his final day as president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association. Chief Brooks, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Right now, Boston's working against us. Yeah, that's normal. You got a murder, no one rats. We don't got that problem. Because in this city, when it comes to terrorism, everybody wants to talk. They release the photos of our guys, sit back and listen, trust me. You gotta start letting Boston work for us, I'm telling you.
That's a scene from the new Mark Wahlberg film, Patriot's Day. It's the Dorchester native and Hollywood's version of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Patriot's Day premiered last night at Boston's Wang Theater. Wahlberg and other stars were there to tread the red carpet. Also there, people who lived through the real bombing and manhunt, including many local law enforcement officials who were about to see themselves depicted on screen. Now, the movie comes some 3.5 years after the actual attack on Boylston Street. Like the rest of us, Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna remembers that day and all that followed. Jamie was part of WBUR's team that covered the federal death penalty trial of convicted bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. So we sent Jamie to last night's premiere of Patriots Day, and he wasn't sure he was ready to see the movie, and he wonders if the city isn't ready too.
I was standing on the red carpet in a tent on Tremont Street. Under the bright lights, there was a line of national and local media, TV crews doing stand-ups, and well-dressed Hollywood stars. But standing behind the metal barricade, I kept thinking back to the three-month-long death penalty trial of convicted bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. I thought of the faces of the families in the courtroom, and so many of the survivors struggling to walk to the stand on prosthetic limbs. That was over a year and a half ago, but the testimony and the images are fresh in my mind. So when Mark Wahlberg made his way down the red carpet rope line to me, I asked him why he wanted to make this movie now.
Everybody knows what they saw on the news, but what they don't know is the story of the people, and that's what we wanted to tell.
Wahlberg plays Boston Police Department Sergeant Tommy Saunders, a fictional composite character of real law enforcement officers involved in the scene of the bombing, the investigation, and the manhunt. The red carpet cleared, and people settled into their seats in the Wang Theater. The Boston Police Department's pipe and drum band marched down the aisles, setting the patriotic tone for Patriots Day. The scene early in the film is that clear April day in 2013, a seemingly normal Marathon Monday.
So much history today to all the runners and the team behind the scenes. Thank you for bringing this race.
And then the bombs go off. The movie intersperses its dramatic recreations with actual news clips, real video taken by people on the scene, and security camera shots, all from that day. The film is bloody, really bloody. At times, it was hard for me to keep my eyes on the screen. Shrapnel and body parts litter Boylston Street. Curdling screams and alarms sound. People apply belt tourniquets to the injured, and police cover, with a sheet, the still body of an 8-year-old boy that we all know is Martin Richard. It was very much like what I saw during Tsarnaev's trial. Footage so bloody and so horrific that some of it couldn't be released publicly. Sounds and video that brought some of the jurors to tears. And last night I kept thinking, this is so still raw for so many of us. Even in the writing of this story today, I cried yet again at my computer.
It brings back a lot of emotion, so whether people accept that or not.
Last night, Boston Police Commissioner William Evans said yes, it's painful to see some of these scenes again. But he believes the makers of Patriots Day did it in a respectful way.
You know, someone was going to do it, and I think they were very sensitive, and I hope people look at it as a positive thing for the city to show how we came together and we made a good thing out of something so negative.
The film follows the same timeline as reality, compressed into 2 hours, moving from the bombing and the investigation to the assassination of MIT police officer Sean Collier and the massive Watertown shootout. And the scenes from Watertown play out like something from the video game Grand Theft Auto, cars flying through the air as the Tsarnaev brothers throw pipe bombs and pressure cookers at the police. There's lots of Hollywood embellishment in these scenes. No cars flew or flipped in Watertown that night. Danny Meng lived through that horrifying night. Just before the manhunt in 2013, the Tsarnaev brothers held him up at gunpoint and carjacked him. And at the film premiere last night, Meng wasn't sure he was ready to relive that again.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Like, kind of get back to that day, feels like. Go through everything again. It's very emotional.
Former Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis says he too wasn't sure he was ready for this movie.
I didn't know if I was ready to see it, but after I left, I felt better.
Davis was asked to consult during the film's production.
My first impulse was to say no,
But Davis says it was the way the producers, director, and Wahlberg approached the material that brought him around. And Wahlberg says he felt it was important for him, a Bostonian, to be the one to make this film.
I took on the responsibility of making sure that we got it right. And if anybody is going to be held accountable in this community, it's me. Yeah. You know, I come here to visit my mom. I want to go to the Boys Club. I want to go to my neighborhood. And I want to be able to, you know, hold my head up and walk the streets with pride.
And it's been a tough few years in terms of terrorist attacks. Boston, in some ways, was the beginning of these lone wolf-style attacks. And there have been so many others since. That's why Watertown Police Sergeant Jeff Pugliese says now's the time for a movie like Patriot's Day.
The world needs to see this, to see what these people are doing. You know, it's just, you know, like what happened in San Bernardino, Belgium, France, Germany. These people out there, you know, trying to demoralize good people. You know, the world needs to see that between the police and the public, we can stop this.
Of course, for the survivors of those terrible days in April 2013, the sufferings never really stopped. Three people lost their lives on Boylston Street that day, and more than 200 people were injured. Of the survivors, two of them were at the premiere last night, Jessica and Patrick Downs. They're portrayed in the film by actors, but they're also in it themselves, because Patriot's Day closes with interviews with actual survivors. Here's Patrick.
Two people took many days and weeks to plan out hate. But love responded in an instant. The bombs went off and wreaked incredible havoc, death, and destruction. But in that immediate instant afterward, people ran toward us.
There's great pride and hope for the city in Patriot's Day. It ends with a celebration of Boston Strong, the survivors and first responders, and the resilience of our city. But Patriot's Day is still a Hollywood depiction of an actual, real-world event. It's not a documentary. It's not a news report. Someone is going to make a profit off of real people's pain. And for so many of us in the Boston area, the pain of those days carries on. There's a scene, after the bombing but before the manhunt, where Wahlberg's character, Tommy Saunders, describes to his wife what he saw at the finish line.
I don't even understand what I saw. I keep seeing this blood, it's like everywhere. And then there was an 8-year-old boy. It was just laying there. They had to take his family away and his parents. And I got these images in my head, and they ain't going away.
We all have these painful, real images in our heads. This movie brings them back yet again.
Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna, reporting on last night's premiere of Patriot's Day. We want to know what you think about this new movie, about the Boston Marathon bombing. Are you going to see it? Do you think it's a good idea? Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been having some conversations with the two major political parties in Massachusetts. Yesterday, we spoke with the newly elected head of the Democratic Party in this state, longtime political operative Gus Bickford. Today, the chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, Quincy City Councilor Kirsten Hughes. She came to our studios earlier today, and we began by discussing the role that Republicans in Massachusetts could have working with the Trump administration.
Look, I think there's opportunities for Massachusetts Republicans to engage with the administration, and Governor Baker not being the most ardent supporter, obviously, of the president-elect, he's going to be able to work across those lines and those divides that they might have to get the best for Massachusetts.
So. Do you think the governor made a mistake by not casting a vote for president at all, and by not
voicing any kind of support for Donald Trump.
No, I don't think it was a mistake. Look, elections are battles. I think they're, you know, wars of ideas. And I think the governor has his ideas and his beliefs, and they didn't line up with Donald Trump. But look, now it switches to governing. The president-elect will recognize that, and I know the governor does. Mm.
Now, you voted for Donald Trump.
I did.
Okay. Now, I'm just curious, did you vote for him because he was at the top of the Republican ticket, or because you also agreed with his positions, his philosophies, his policies?
You know, in part because he was at the top of the ticket, because he is the party's nominee, and I share more ideologically aligned with the Republican Party. I had certainly had some issues with his tone and his presentation at times, and some concerns about those choices. But at the end of the day, it was about securing our country, making sure that we turn the page from the Obama years, and I believed that he represented a change that this country needs. Yeah.
So let me ask you, especially vis-a-vis the Republican Party in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. do you think that that we can say that Republicanism or the party itself is now the party of Trump? Is that what represents what Republicanism means to you here in Massachusetts?
I think you can be a supporter of Trump, of the president, and also be a supporter of a more moderate stream of Republicanism that we represent really here in Massachusetts.
Now, I'm going to ask you in a minute about sort of priorities for you and the party here in the state for 2018 in just a second. But
sure.
But this is such a change moment, right, that we're in. There has been a lot of discussion about the future of the Democratic Party and also the future of the Republican Party, even though there was such a large victory in November. I'm wondering if you think that, in a way, are Massachusetts Republicans sort of uniquely positioned to be loyal critics of the president-elect when needed? Like, when he says things, which I don't think he's showing us any signs that he wouldn't, you know, when he says things that people continue to find troubling about individual groups or individual religions, things like that, do you think that there's a role to play for Massachusetts Republicans in standing up and saying, we support you, Mr. President, but we don't necessarily support what you're saying?
There's a role for you know, everyone to do that on either side of the aisle. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, we have to wait. We have to see what the president is going to actually do. He hasn't even been inaugurated. But with Trump's election, I think there was a real rejection of, again, business as usual, being politically correct, being sort of afraid to say things, afraid to talk about things, sort of taking a different tact, an outside the beltway view of things. And I think people found that refreshing. And so I don't expect him to be any different from that. And I think that's what people liked about him. I think that's what they elected.
Yeah. You know, but we are seeing sort of the push-pull of how much what Donald Trump represents, how much that means to the Republican Party, even here in the state, because you're up for re-election as party chair next month, right?
Yes.
And I understand that you've got enough commitments from the state committee to remain chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. But nevertheless, you still have a challenger, right?
Yes.
State committee member Steve Aylward, who is a Trump loyalist, and he said that the party here in the state did little, barely anything in his estimation, to promote Donald Trump's candidacy. And what's your response to that?
Well, first of all, I'm proud to have the support of the majority of the committee. I think that we've done a great job. We had our best year. We were able to keep all of the incumbents safe on Beacon Hill and add a seat, which has not been done in over 30 years in a presidential year. And, you know, we did do things to support the top of the ticket. The fact remains that the Massachusetts Republican Party is responsible for those down ballot races for Massachusetts Republicans. And so we took that responsibility very seriously. We worked very closely in a way that we've never done before in terms of digital, our infrastructure, get out the vote methods, giving more money to candidates locally than we have ever in the past. And so I really saw our responsibility was to that bottom of the ticket. So I feel like we did our job there.
So what are your priorities as party chair for 2017, 2018?
Right. Since I've come on as chairman, we've done a much better job of reaching out to those municipal Republicans, something that the party did not do in the past. I'm a counselor in Quincy, I see the value of building that bench. And that's really what has been lacking in Massachusetts. The other focus certainly is to look and recruit candidates for 2018 and to get some help on Beacon Hill for the governor and the lieutenant governor for their agenda, and certainly keeping the governor's office.
You know, yesterday we spoke with Gus Bickford, who's the head of the State Democratic Party. And so you heard where his focus is. His focus is on the governor's office for 2018. And I just want to play a little bit of tape from our conversation yesterday. Here's Gus Bickford talking about how he wants the Massachusetts Democratic Party to defeat Governor Baker in 2018. And one of the reasons why is he told us that he believes the governor should be out in front opposing several of President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nominees, including a nominee for EPA, Attorney General, and Secretary of State. So here's Gus Bickford.
The governor needs to, frankly, be out front and say, as the CEO of the state, this is not good for us. We need, you know, our governor to take a position because he is a voice for us. And so far, he's just said, wait and see. That's not good enough.
So, Swain, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, even President Obama said, let's wait and see. I mean, the governor was very clear that he was concerned about Steve Bannon being named to the Trump inner circle. He was clear about that. He's talked about working with the administration. That shows true leadership to wait and see. So I appreciate Gus's job as the chair of the Democratic Party, but I don't think that that's a valid criticism of the governor right now. And, you know, we do have to wait and see. And the governor has a job of governing, and he has to work with folks to get the best for Massachusetts. And so, you know, I think his attitude and his his feelings on national issues are known, and I think it's a valid point.
Well, so I mean, obviously, Charlie Baker is very popular in Massachusetts. Yeah. He's a hugely popular governor here. But, you know, on the other hand, he also was sort of on the losing side of two of the ballot questions that Massachusetts voters voted on. Question two about charter schools and question four about marijuana legalization, which happens today. So I'm wondering, I mean, that in the minds of folks like Gus Bickford, they believe that that's sort of an area of weakness for Governor Baker when it comes time for re-election. And do you agree with that? Do you think that the governor has shown some weakness in terms of standing on the opposite side of key issues that Massachusetts voters are?
So Charlie Baker in 2018 is going to be able to run on his record. And there's scant evidence out there for Gus to point to where Governor Baker has done, you know, anything less than a stellar job here in Massachusetts. So the governor is going to be able to run on his record of working on the opioid crisis, making sure that the dollars at the MBTA are being spent wisely, making sure that jobs come back to Massachusetts. Today, 2.9% unemployment rate here in Massachusetts, one of, if not the lowest unemployment rates in the United States. So did he go out there for charter schools, something he feels very passionately about, genuine, you know, belief that giving kids in the inner cities an opportunity to choose the schools that they want to go to give them a better education? I think that was a great opportunity for the government for the governor to get into communities where he maybe, you know, doesn't get to go to all the time, like urban communities, communities of color.
So let me ask you about that, because that brings us to something I was wondering about, a challenge that the Massachusetts Republican Party faces in terms of diversifying the party, right? I mean, of the 80 committee members with the Republican Party here, I believe only just one is just a person of color, right?
I don't know anything about that, but yes.
So do you see that as a challenge in terms of diversifying committee members of the party here?
It would be great if we could, you know, field. First of all, committee members are elected every 4 years. So we have done our best. I know in 2014, I did an urban cities tour. I myself am from a city where, you know, there's a high Asian population. We've reached out to folks in those communities. I went to a lot of communities of color with our statewide candidates of 14. So we, you know, have worked to improve our listening with communities of color. And, you know, I think that's a work in progress for sure. And we can always make strides in that area.
So we talked about the governor's office. Yeah. I'm curious about how optimistic you feel about the congressional delegation, because it's been all blue for quite a while.
Right.
I mean, do you think that the Massachusetts Republican Party can break into that?
Yeah, there are certainly areas within the state that are, you know, opportunities for us to pick up a seat down in the Cape, and the 9th Congressional District is a good place. You know, you have the Songhees Congressional District and, you know, Seth Moulton, who we'd had Richard Tsayan in the past. So there are opportunities for us to pick up statewide in the congressional delegation. And, you know, Senator Warren is up for re-election. Also a treasure trove.
Are you giving her notice, right?
Also, any candidate who runs against Senator Warren certainly has a record.
Are you endorsing Kurt Schilling right now?
I don't know Kurt Schilling. I haven't spoken to him, so I don't know if he's running. But no matter who's running against Elizabeth Warren, they're going to have an opportunity to dive into her, again, erratic record, her, you know, drive-by senatorial attitude here in Massachusetts. And I think they're going to have an opportunity to really pick apart and run a good race.
Yeah. Massachusetts Republicans, historically in the United States, have a long and rich and deep history. Historically, it's a different kind of Republicanism mm-hmm. than we've seen over the past, you know, a couple of generations, and especially now. I mean, what do you think represents Massachusetts Republicanism? And do you think that that is different than what we see in terms of the party nationally overall?
I think it could be different. Look, there are certainly people within our party who have differing opinions on social issues. And what works for a Republican in Ashburnham doesn't necessarily work for a Republican running in Quincy, say, right? So I think that there will always be those differences. But, you know, at the end of the day, being a Massachusetts Republican means bringing some balance to a state which is overwhelmingly Democratic, you know, and I think that time and again you've seen that's why folks in Massachusetts elect a Republican governor. They like to see that Democrats up on Beacon Hill, that their feet are being held to the fire, that there is some check and balance.
Well, Kirsten Hughes is chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party and president of the Quincy City Council. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And as we mentioned, we spoke with the newly elected state Democratic Party chair, Gus Bickford, yesterday. You can find a link to that conversation at our website, radioboston.org. Now, before we head into the break, a little check-in on the weather, because it's cold out there and it's going to get even colder. Arctic temperatures are headed towards Massachusetts tonight. Temps are expected to dip down to -3 in some places. That's a challenge for everyone, including the MBTA. I trust you have not forgotten how tea service struggled with the cold in winters past. But MBTA spokesman Joe Pesaturo says that the T is already taking action to prevent cold-related delays tonight and tomorrow morning.
When the temperatures get this cold, it's very important to just keep everything moving. So crews will also be exercising car doors on the subway trains, meaning opening and closing them just to prevent freeze-ups, and also will be exercising track switches, same thing, just to prevent freeze-ups there.
Good to know that exercise can keep trains warm just like it keeps people warm. Now, T officials are encouraging people to check the web, the official MBTA app, and MBTA Twitter for real-time updates again tonight and tomorrow. On a more serious note, cold, of course, can be very dangerous, so please stay inside whenever possible, stay warm, and stay tuned because there's more of the show coming up right after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Kenneth Lonergan's film Manchester by the Sea is set against the bleak, beautiful background of the Massachusetts coast in winter. Casey Affleck plays Lee, a janitor who is pulled back to Manchester after the death of his brother Joe. Sitting in a lawyer's office, Lee learns that he's been made the guardian of his teenage nephew, Patrick.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well,
I mean, I can't.
Well, naturally, I assumed Joe had discussed all this with you.
No. He didn't. No.
However, Lee is left to take care of a teenager who's balancing his own father's death with hockey practice and two girlfriends. Lee is also back in a town he left behind after a tragedy that shattered his life years earlier. Kenneth Lonergan directed and wrote Manchester by the Sea, which has just been nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Motion Picture Drama. He's also received nominations for Best Director and Best Screenplay. And he joins us now from New York. Kenneth Lonergan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to start by telling you congratulations on the film. The Golden Globe nominations are much deserved. But I also wanted to read to you a particular quotation that comes from New Yorker writer Rebecca Mead. She wrote that Manchester by the Sea burrows into the mind of a man who experiences a trauma that neither kills him nor makes him stronger. Rather, it leaves him maimed. Now, when Matt Damon first came to you for the idea for this film, given that if that's an accurate representation of what the film's about, what was your reaction to this storyline?
Well, I thought it was, obviously I thought it was a really interesting idea for a story. I wouldn't have taken it on. I thought it was just a really powerful situation, and I was interested in investigating it. I think that's an accurate way of describing it, but that's just an opinion. For me, it's more about what the story's about and trying to get the characters moving through it rather than characterizing it one way or the other. Mm.
So tell me, in your words, what is this story about?
Well, so having let myself in for that, I guess the story is about I think you described it very well. It's that's what the plot is, and it's to me the bigger things it's about are people moving on while they're carrying around a lot of grief, people taking care of each other when they're under extreme duress. I suppose those are the two main things I feel the movie's about.
Yeah. I mean, so really one of the underlying events in the film is a truly unspeakable tragedy. I mean, unspeakable to me is exactly the word, so I'm not going to describe what it is. But there's a sense that in the movie, as you're saying, it's like it's about how people can't really move on, don't really move on. It's sort of an anti-Hollywood film in that regard, don't you think?
Yes, I do think so, but incidentally so. I didn't set out to make an anti-Hollywood film, except that I don't like that particular trope that is often ladled into movies, whereby people find some kind of beautiful sentimental resolution to something that's initially presented as being unbearably painful. I mean, I don't think you can have it both ways. If you're going to, I don't like action movies, for instance, that exploit the reality of real people getting blown up and then switch over and say that it's fun to shoot bad guys off the roof. Or, I don't think you can say explosions are fun and horrible in the same movie. I think it's sort of a moral lie in a way. I like, in the very first Star Wars, Darth Vader blows up an entire planet, but nobody takes it that seriously because it's not presented as being serious. It's presented as being a comic book. Mm-hmm. And on that level, I think it's fine. If it was also to try to get us to feel the suffering of the millions of people who were blown up, I think it would be another story. I think it would be a very unpleasant and ugly film in some ways, but it isn't. So obviously my film is nothing like Star Wars, but I try to take the situation seriously, both in the presentation of the difficulties and in the realities of how well or how much it can get resolved.
Yeah. So let me ask you about that, because I think one of the masterful things in the film is that how much of that, what you just said, like people feeling, living the real experiences of grief, how they cope with it or maybe don't, is so brilliantly, chillingly communicated through Casey Affleck's acting of the part of Lee. And in fact, the part of what got me is that he doesn't say much. He doesn't have a ton of dialogue. There's a lot of his grief is in the totality of his body, in his face. He really lives it.
Yeah, and it's an amazing performance. He's just a great, great actor with a capital G, in my opinion. And I think that but it's such a very full performance because his behavior, his mind is always working and his emotions are always working. And it's not a stoic performance by any means. He's someone who's very actively trying to ward off these terrible feelings and these bad memories and is trying to keep himself very busy and who's immersed in the practical side of life and fixing things and arranging things. He's a very able character. He's very good at taking charge and making sure things go as smoothly as possible, even though he's at a social disconnect with most of the people around him. But another thing that I think is, if you're going to try to talk about or you try to explore in a fictional setting grief and the repercussions of the sorrows that everyone's experienced and some sorrows that not all of us have experienced, is that it's not something that's there all the time either. It's something that comes sneaks up on you. It's something that you can put away for a while. It's something that's around the corner. And you don't always, you know, if you hear your very early in the film, his brother dies and, you know, he doesn't burst into tears and have a monologue about it. Most of us don't. When we hear someone close to us has passed away, the reaction's often delayed. It's often submerged. It's often lost in the details of what you have to do when someone does pass away. Just the way your life is kind of wrapped up in details when things are going very well.
Right, right. I mean, I want to ask you about one particular scene in terms of how you wrote it or how you tapped into putting on the screen a more realistic representation about how people do have that delayed processing of, I mean, processing isn't even the right word, but delayed experience of grief. Because there's a very harrowing scene where Casey Affleck's character, Lee, there's a terrible thing going on and he's just holding on to a bag.
Yeah.
And clamped onto it. And I read an interview where Casey Affleck himself said that the first time he saw that scene in the script, in his words, he was like, what's really going on here? He wasn't quite sure why the character was doing that and not much else. And then later on, he said he did the scene and he held onto the bag and figured out that that's exactly what his character was trying to do at that moment, just barely holding on. So you wrote that.
Yes, and he did it.
Well, so tell me, when you wrote it, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but when you wrote that scene, the first time you sort of conceived of it, did you think about that him holding the bag was going to be so symbolic?
Not in a symbolic way, but in a literal way and in an emotional way. You know, it's a grocery bag. He's gone out for groceries, and I more or less tried to imagine the scene as if it were a real scene and write down what I saw. And I had this image of him clutching onto this bag of groceries. And when we went to shoot the scene, he's holding on the groceries and then he puts the groceries down and he picks the groceries back up when he gets particularly lost in a conversation with the police. And he's looking for something to hold on to just to get his bearings. And you can then later go out and extrapolate how it's certainly has some real metaphorical value. But at the, you know, like a lot of emotional moments in life, we then act out. You know, you can find yourself holding onto a table very hard when you're hearing some very difficult news, and it's quite natural to want to hold on to something. Or you get a floating sensation when you feel like you're lost, and it's not. I try to stay away from metaphors, from consciously using metaphors, because I think I think they come up all over the place anyway. It's just the natural way our minds work.
Yeah.
Everyone who has dreams at night dreams metaphorically.
Have you always been such a careful student of the unspoken ways human beings are communicating?
I don't know. We all notice different things about the world, and I certainly am very interested in how people interact with each other and with their environment. And one of those ways is verbal and one is nonverbal. And they're inextricably linked together, and I am certainly very interested in it.
Yeah. Well, I want to play another little scene here from Manchester by the Sea. A lot of people have called this one of the emotional emotional apex of the scene, and it's actually very of the movie, I should say, and it's actually very quiet. So here we're going to hear Casey Affleck again. He plays the role of Lee. And he's speaking to Michelle Williams, who plays Lee's ex-wife, Randy, and they run into each other on the street in Manchester after Lee has been back in town for some time.
I don't have anything big to say.
It's okay.
Just, I know you've been around, and I...
Just been getting Patrick settled in.
It seems like he's doing pretty good, huh, considering?
I think he is, yeah.
I guess you don't know this, but I really kept in touch with Joe. It's been kind of weird for me not seeing Patrick. Oh, okay. I didn't know.
If you could see him if you want.
Could we ever have lunch?
You mean us? You and me?
Yeah.
Now, I love my medium of radio, but really that's a scene that needs to be... You need to see it in order to understand exactly the immensity of what's happening there. You directed this film, too. So can you talk about directing that scene in particular?
Sure. I mean, the famous thing about directing is once you've done the casting, you've done 90% of your work with the actors, which is true. And, you know, every time I hear or see or think of that scene, I just think how great they both are. You can just feel how emotionally full they are and how difficult it is for her to start this conversation and how he's trying to you could describe it at great length, and you're basically describing all the complicated ups and downs that they're both going through in that little opening of the conversation. And essentially, you know, we track through the scene, you know, at a table together, and we discussed kind of when the last time the two of them had met so that they would both have the same understanding, and we discussed what had happened the last few times they'd met and where they were each at in the present. We see them at some length earlier in the film, 5 years earlier, when everything's going really well and they're still married. And it's a very different scene, but just, I guess what they do, you know, you just try to help them point them in the right direction and let them go, really, because mm-hmm. they're such good actors. They've thought so much about the characters and about where the characters are and who they are to each other. And all you really do as a director with some scenes is figure out where you want to put the camera. And that's a very deep art that I'm trying to learn more about, but where to put the camera that just seems the most natural. It seems like the one place the camera should be. And really give the actors a chance to play the scene. You know, we knew this was an important scene, so we set aside a half day for it, which is a lot on a film set. We only shot for 32 days, so that's a big piece of our schedule. And we wanted to make sure that it fell late in the schedule so that they would have gotten some time to live with the characters and live with the situation. So we really were, so in a way you organize things so that you don't have to do much directing when you're there.
Right.
But all of that organization is directing also, I suppose.
Hmm. So the film is set, of course, in Manchester on Massachusetts North Shore. You did a lot of actual shooting there. Insofar as the story that you're telling in the movie, could you have told the story if it were set elsewhere?
Well, I could have told the story elsewhere, but not this story in this way elsewhere, because, you know, one of the great things about working on this project was that I didn't know, I wasn't, you know, intimately familiar with Cape Ann before I started, and, you know, can't claim to be intimately familiar with it now, but I did get to know it pretty well, and I got to know it very well in terms of what I needed to use for this particular film. And I got to incorporate what I was learning as I was writing the script and as we were prepping the movie and as we were shooting the movie. So the entire area, you know, it's set in Manchester, but it's also there's a lot of scenes in Gloucester. There's some scenes in Beverly. And we sort of meander all over the place, as, you know, people from the area know. It's a pretty – all those towns are nestled in pretty tightly together. It was really one of the most enjoyable things about directing the film was watching the area seep into the material in a way that couldn't be got out again. Uh-huh. There's a lot of logistical problems that come up in the story, and all of the logistical problems that work their way into the script and into the film are logistical problems that come out of the geography of the area. Just for example, Lee's got to get to the hospital where Kyle Chandler's character would have been taken is in Beverly. The school is in Manchester, and the hockey rink where Patrick is playing hockey is in Gloucester, which is all things that I learned doing research. So that works itself into the narrative really nicely, because a big part of the first part of the story is Lee trying to get up there in time before his brother dies. Then when he has died, he has to get to deliver the news personally to his nephew because he doesn't want anyone else to do it. That involves going back to Manchester, where he doesn't want to be, which kicks off a tremendous wave of unwelcome memories. And when he gets to Manchester, he finds out that the kid isn't in Manchester. He's gone up to Gloucester for hockey practice, so he has to drive up to Gloucester. And in real life, when you have to do that kind of arranging when your brother's just passed away, it has a big effect on your on how things go. And it also tells us about him and how dutifully he's trying to take care of all this difficult business.
Yeah, I mean, one reviewer wrote of your movie that that Kenneth Lonergan is after a kind of realism rarely found in recent American movies, and I would have to agree with that.
Well, it's very generous.
Kenneth Lonergan, he's the writer and director of Manchester by the Sea. It's been nominated for 5 Golden Globes, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay, and Best Actor for Casey Affleck. Kenneth Lonergan, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.